They don't call them Allbirds. They call them Amazon brand 206 Collective Men's Galen Black Wool 10 Medium US.
Obviously. Much catchier.
Yes.
Dude, I got my new 206 Collectives last week.
Welcome to the GeekWire podcast. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
I'm GeekWire civic editor Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm GeekWire managing editor Taylor Soper.
We had a big week of news out there, and later on we're going to be talking about one of the most attention-getting articles on GeekWire this past week, the scoop that you got, Monica, on the shutdown of LimePod, the free-floating car-sharing service that was being piloted here in Seattle as a test for whether it would work in other cities. We're going to be talking about that later on, and I can't wait to dive into that because I have lots of opinions on it. But there was also this movement that just became very visible in the tech industry, the push for companies to take action on climate change and to take steps to reduce their impact on the environment. Monica, you just got back from a massive demonstration on the streets of Seattle. Describe what you saw and how it fits into this larger picture.
That's right. I got back, filed my story, and here we are. So it's very fresh in my memory. This was a huge demonstration. It was really kind of impressive to see. So on Amazon's campus in downtown Seattle, there were thousands of people who came out as part of this global strike to demand climate action. And the Amazon event was sort of an offshoot of that, organized by Amazon employees. Google employees also got involved. And their goal is to really pressure their employers to step up on climate change and be leaders in this.
So what was it like out there?
It was really inspiring. The energy was very, very positive. There were tons of people. The employees who organized the event were giving speeches. They had written songs specific to this protest, and they were teaching them to the crowd. So there was a lot of chanting and singing, and it really felt like a forceful protest movement.
Sing it back. Don't speed up. The people gonna rise like the water.
We're gonna calm this crisis down.
We're gonna calm this crisis down.
I hear the voice of my great granddaughter.
I hear the voice of my great granddaughter.
Saying climate justice now.
Saying climate justice now.
There were also a lot of kids, a lot of dogs. People were excited and talking to each other. And after a round of speeches in the shadow of this big Amazon tower, everyone started to march to Seattle City Hall, where there is a much bigger demonstration going on.
What was their message? What were they asking for?
Their message was pretty clear and cohesive. They want their employers to be more transparent about their carbon footprints. They want them to end any contracts with fossil fuel companies that allow them to continue looking for and producing more fossil fuels. And they want them to commit to zero or net less than zero carbon emissions over the next few years, kind of in line with the Paris Agreement that says that we really, really need to make dramatic shifts in order to prevent the climate from warming to catastrophic degrees.
So I know this was an event in Seattle, but it ties into international demonstrations.
It does. Yes, this is a rare issue that has united people across the spectrum, young people, old people, tech workers, blue collar workers. There are demonstrations in developed countries like Australia and the US and Germany, but also in Asia, in Africa, all over the world. People are joining this movement that was started by young people, by high school kids.
Wow. Okay.
And it's interesting this happened today, but one day earlier, Amazon sort of got ahead of this protest, if you will, with their own announcement.
Yeah, there's like a cynical view and an optimistic view, I would say, of this. So the cynical view is that Amazon kind of does its thing for a while until it gets enough pressure and then it makes a change. Like we saw this with the minimum wage. They were getting a lot of pressure from Senator Bernie Sanders and others about what they pay warehouse workers. And then they came out with a $15 minimum wage. Similarly, the group that organized this protest today, Amazon Employees for Climate Justice, have been really pushing their employer to meet some of these goals and be more transparent. And this climate change walkout was known. Amazon knew this was going to happen. So the timing, I don't think, is a coincidence that a day before they said, hey, we're doing this. But they had already committed to releasing their carbon footprint this year. And this has been in the works for a while. They have known that they needed to be a better leader on this because they're kind of falling behind other tech companies. And they are making some real commitments.
In fact, we have a clip of Jeff Bezos introducing this Amazon climate plan in a very Jeff Bezos way. Let's hear that now.
You might recognize this. This is Earth. It's the best planet in the solar system. We know that because we've sent robotic probes. It's the only good planet in the solar system, and we need to take care of it. We have some news that we'd like to announce, and we're very excited to do it. Today, we are announcing the Climate Pledge. The Climate Pledge is to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement 10 years early. Amazon becomes the first signatory to the Climate Pledge. So when you sign the Climate Pledge, what are you agreeing to do? Number one, you're agreeing to measure and report your emissions on a regular basis. Number two, to implement decarbonization strategies in line with the Paris Agreement, which basically means that these are real things that you're doing in your business, things that you're changing. You're changing your actual business activities to eliminate carbon. And then third, with any remaining emissions that you cannot eliminate with real change, you are agreeing to do offsets that are credible. And what do we mean by credible offsets? We mean nature-based solutions. That's the key.
All right, so there it is. Amazon will be the first signatory to this plan, essentially implementing the Paris Climate Accord on their own 10 years before the deadlines. This, to me, Monica, was fascinating because it's hard to tell cause and effect. Clearly, the Amazon employees who are taking a stand on this issue are pressuring the company to take action. And yet, if you talk to the company, they say, oh, this is something we were going to do anyway. How do you sort that out?
In the end, I don't know how much it really matters. The goal is the same, which is to get Amazon to reduce its carbon emissions and join this fight. Now, it's kind of interesting, too, because when you think about it relative to Amazon's competitors, they produce more carbon emissions and their commitments are not as ambitious as some of their tech industry peers like Apple, Google. But they are emitting far less than what they say is their chief rival, Walmart. So depending on how you define this business, they're either being a leader or they're just kind of joining the pack.
This comes at the same time that the United States essentially backed out of the Paris Climate Accord. And it ties into some of the broader themes in the book by Brad Smith that we both read and we both interviewed him about. And that is that in many cases, you have companies stepping up and playing a role that countries would have played in the past. And in part, it's interesting because companies are, by definition, global, if they're this large, crossing international boundaries, yet they're not elected. And yet they're taking this action that can compel others to follow suit. It's a much different dynamic, say, than the United Nations, without the accountability of representative government, but also much more economic power in some cases. It's just a fascinating dynamic.
This is one of the most interesting stories of the technology industry to me, and it is explored quite a bit in Brad's book. And at one point, he talks about how Denmark was the first country to create an ambassador to the technology industry. And the financial minister there said, these tech companies are in many ways more powerful than countries, and we need an ambassador to talk to them. But what's really interesting here to me is diplomacy. A lot of diplomacy and international multilateral agreements have kind of broken down from the U.S. government perspective, but a company like Microsoft is able to negotiate and create deals and set policies around really big issues like cybersecurity and data privacy. And you're right, Todd. I mean, these aren't people we've elected to represent us, and more they are representing us in these really important matters.
You had the story this week, Taylor, about Microsoft's employees themselves being up in arms over its partnership with oil industry giants.
Yeah, and the other interesting part of this is this power of the employee now and the employee activist movement specifically at these tech companies and kind of the impact that they're having basically by raising these concerns. We've seen it across different topics, whether it's, you know, employees not wanting Amazon to work on military-related contracts, and not just at Amazon but at Google. And it's just interesting to see kind of the power of the employee. And, you know, it's it's also about recruiting and PR for these companies too. So it's a tight labor market, and that recruiting is really tough. So I think that's probably going through the minds of Amazon and all these other company executives.
Right. They have so much power. I mean, Google canceled a government contract because of employee activism, but it's something that could really only happen, I think, in the tech industry, because there are so many more open positions than there are people with the skills to fill them. So, you know, this is exactly what somebody I talked to at the Amazon protest today, Jacob Adamson, he's a developer for Amazon. This is what he said, is that we have a lot of leverage and there are tons of workers across the world who don't have the luxury of speaking up and trying to pressure their employees. So it's incumbent upon us. But I do wonder, what if the labor market shifts? What if all of these new computer science graduates flood the market and all of a sudden employers have the power again? Will we stop seeing these trends?
It's interesting because you're talking about the cyclical nature of the economy and the tech industry. I actually think that the key trend here is much longer term, and that is generational. I think there is a big portion of this where the number of millennials coming into the workforce, caring about social issues, holding their employers, their bosses, the people running these companies for now to account on these issues is starting to have a major impact. I do agree with you that the economy and clearly the power of the tech industry is playing a role as well, but I think this is longer term.
That's really interesting, because then what happens when these millennials start running these companies? Are they going to hold on to their social justice ethos? Are they going to just, you know, become the man? I'm curious what this looks like in 10, 20 years.
I think you got a book here. That's a really interesting question. It'd be a really interesting study, like a longitudinal study. Now we're really nerding out, so we better stop.
All right. What's our next story?
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will talk about getting around town and how it just got a lot harder, not only in Seattle, but potentially other places because of what just happened here. That's coming up next on GeekWire.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back to GeekWire. It's Todd Bishop with Monica Nicholsberg and Taylor Soper. All right, so we've already talked about one of your stories for the week, Monica. You had a scoop earlier in the week about LimePod. Now, not everybody in the world knows what LimePod is. In fact, not everybody in the country knows what LimePod is, because it was ours.
It was only in Seattle.
And it's gone.
I can tell you have a lot of feelings about that.
Sad about it, dude.
I'm being somewhat dramatic, obviously, but I do have some very strong personal feelings about this, born of the frustration of using other platforms that were much worse. Anyway, let's explain.
So LimePod is the car sharing experiment from Lime, the company that if you are outside of Seattle, you might only know for their bright green scooters, maybe their bikes. It's a new mobility company that has descended on cities all over the country with their bikes and scooters and are offering to change how people get around. In Seattle, they decided to experiment with car sharing as well. So they had about 500 Fiats that were placed around town that you could open with an app, drive to your destination, drop off anywhere you can park a car on city streets. And it was pretty popular and growing. Yet this week, they decided the program will be no more.
The official reason was that they weren't able to find a partner to work with them to roll out an all-electric fleet.
That is what they said. Yeah, they said that they're an all-electric company and their ethos is reducing vehicle use and reducing fossil fuel emissions. And they had agreed to do this pilot in City of Seattle until December 31st, 2019. And with that deadline approaching, they just decided to sunset the program because they couldn't figure out a way to make the fleet electric.
Clever marketing, clever PR, but as you get into your story, Monica, the economics of this is difficult. And beyond that, just running this from Lime's perspective, it's a pain. And as you also reported a few weeks ago, Reach Now, which was the other free-floating car sharing service that also shut down, you know, the leaders of that, former leaders, talked about the difficulty of maintaining the cars. You know, there's some crime implications. People are using Lion Pods to basically steal packages and do all this crazy stuff. And so this is just really hard to run on top of the business model maybe not working out. But it's just interesting because I think just a few weeks ago, the spokesman for Lion was telling you how amazing this thing was going. And then all of a sudden, it doesn't work because of electrical issues. It just seems like the business wasn't working.
What we know for sure is the underlying economics of free-floating car sharing are very difficult. You have to make sure that it's convenient, that anytime somebody opens an app looking for a car, they can find one within walking distance. And that means moving these cars around cities, which requires, you know, at least two guys in a car going to a car. One of them moves it somewhere else, and he needs to get picked up, not to mention they need to be fueled. The liability is higher. Servicing them is more difficult. If there's an issue, they need to be towed. Compared with bikes and scooters that you can just throw in a van, it's very capital intensive. So that is a challenge. Now, there's one car sharing service still in Seattle who seems to have made it work, and that's Car2Go. They've been here since 2012, and they were the first in Seattle.
As you also noted in your story, Car2Go and these other models are working actually in other cities. Maybe not so much in the U.S., but just north of us in Vancouver, B.C. It's actually working really well, according to people who've used it there. And in Europe, this model is quite popular, and there's several companies doing it. So it's just interesting that it didn't quite work in Seattle, where there's a lot of techie folks that like to test new things. And to your point, Todd, I actually really like these services, whether it was going to the airport and dropping off the Reach Now and hopping on a flight, or just getting from A to B, you know, before you go out and going to the bar, you haven't, you know, done your partying yet, and you want to just don't want to take an Uber or Lyft, which, by the way, were always more expensive than these car sharing services. So it was a cheaper service. You had the privacy of your own car. Basically, you could drive it. I don't know. It was a great service. And Todd, tell me more about why you are disappointed that this is over.
So I've never actually used Car2Go. I think the reason I didn't originally sign up was because they had those tiny little cars. And I recognized that the Lime Pods were tiny as well, but for some reason, they just seemed better. So I use Reach Now quite a bit. And my big problem with that service, which was from BMW, was the tech. I felt like I would end my ride, and inevitably I was unable to actually end the ride in the app, and I felt spend more money sitting there waiting for the thing to connect. It was cumbersome to start. You had to get in, enter your PIN. I loved Lime because it was integrated into the same app as the bikes and then potentially the scooters down the road. You were able to just scan it just like you did the bikes. You got in, keys were there, turned the keys, you left. It was simple, easy. And I ended up using it instead of Reach Now, before Reach Now closed, because of the ease of use. I think it's a bummer because I feel like they nailed the user experience.
Both of these services were very popular with customers in Seattle. What I learned from talking to experts is everything has to go right for car sharing to be economical. The margins are really, really small. I mean, they're not actually typically profitable, at least in the initial years. But the main things that companies have to solve for are convenience and affordability. Convenience, the car has to be near you. We just talked about why that's so hard. Affordability, it has to be cheap enough that a customer is going to use it over other modes of transportation. And that includes things that you might not think about, like parking. If you have to drive around looking for a parking space to leave the car in, then you're spending more money. That hurts convenience and affordability. Seattle is not the easiest place to park. It's got a lot of congestion, so sitting in these cars can rank up the cost. That hurts the affordability. It's also competitive. There are a ton of ways to get around Seattle because companies like to launch here, because we've got this tech-savvy workforce that they think is going to be quick to adopt a new service, and it's a growing population, growing market. And I think all of these little things were kind of the death by a thousand cuts to these services.
The problem with those experimental services is that you get used to using them. You incorporate them into your life. It's great that we have access to them, but then they go away. I don't think many people here knew that LimePod was just here. In fact, I think it was a bit of a surprise. And I wonder if people had known it was truly a pilot, if they would have had the same level of adoption.
It's possible. But your first comment kind of gets to this bigger issue that I wrote a follow-up story about this on GeekWire this week. Something really new is happening here. We are starting to rely on private companies to get around cities in a way that really only the public sector served before. You know, public transit walking or personal cars and bikes were the only way that people really got around cities for decades. And now these companies are coming in. They're kind of flooding a city with a new service that maybe residents will get used to using and relying on. And there's no guarantee of ongoing public taxpayer funding, so they can go belly up a year later, and then all of a sudden this mobility service that people relied on isn't there anymore. So I don't know that it's necessarily a bad thing, but I do think it's worth examining what happens when we start relying on private companies to get us around.
You know, earlier I was kind of chiding you or saying, are you really that disappointed, Todd? But I think I saw tweets of people saying that they had relied on LimePod when their car was broken, or they had even decided to get rid of their car altogether because the service existed. So I think it did take away a big part of people's life, you know, how they get to place A to place B every day. So it's interesting. Do we rely on public transit? Do we rely on the private companies and the push and pull between those? And also how cities interact with these companies. For example, the city of Seattle lately has been having some interesting interactions with Uber and Lyft, and who controls what.
So what happened on that front this week?
Big week. A lot of news. The city of Seattle is considering new regulations on Uber and Lyft that would implement a fee per ride that would bring the total fee per ride to 75 cents. And they're going to start a study with the goal of creating a minimum wage for drivers, a minimum hourly rate that they're entitled to. That could potentially have long-term impacts on Uber and Lyft in the city of Seattle. In New York, when they implemented this type of fee and minimum wage, Uber and Lyft started locking drivers out of the app during periods of low demand. It is a much higher fee there, but the companies have said this could result in higher costs for our riders or other changes.
Well, you can catch up with all of that coverage at geekwire.com. We will link to Monica's stories, which formed the entire basis for the news segments of our podcast this week, at geekwire.com and in the show notes on this podcast. We'll be right back with the Random Channel. You're listening to GeekWire. Welcome back to GeekWire. It's time for the Random Channel, that moment of the week when we talk about the random items we were buzzing about behind the scenes at GeekWire this week. Who wants to start?
I'll start. I always have depressing random channels, but here we go.
Keep the streak alive. Let's go.
To keep the streak alive, do you know how much plastic you are ingesting?
No, I don't, Monica.
A lot.
Tell me.
There's a new study out that says American adults inhale and consume at least 98,000 pieces of plastic every year.
How does that happen?
It's little particles. One of the biggest culprits is water. And you would think tap water is probably an issue, right? Like it's not filtered. I should switch to filtered water, but it's actually got lower plastic compared with bottled water. So stop drinking bottled water. It's bad for the environment and bad for your body. But also it's kind of a losing battle because you're going to inhale all this plastic anyway. It's in our sea salt. It's microplastics, man.
Wow. Okay.
Todd's looking at the water he's drinking right now.
Well, no. I got this from that nice filtered canister we have out there. You know, the one that...
Yes, the Berkey. That is the Mercedes of water filters.
Yes, I know. My wife didn't want it in the kitchen, so we got it at GeekWire.
I have one at home.
Yes, it's nice.
How do we avoid plastic?
We can't really avoid it. It's everywhere and it doesn't break down. And it's... The microplastics that we're talking about come off of pretty much anything that's made of plastic. I mean, if you avoid plastic packaging, that helps. Never heat anything up that's in plastic. Never put plastic in the microwave. Don't drink water from plastic bottles. Really anything that's got like that softer, flimsy plastic that you can kind of crinkle, that is something to avoid.
Taylor, my random channel relates directly to you.
Give it to me.
So there was a tweet this week that pointed out a new line of shoes, or at least a newly discovered line of shoes on Amazon that are almost exactly like Allbirds, except a fraction of the cost. And this was an example held up on social media of Amazon essentially cloning another company's products. You can debate whether or not that's tradition in retail or unique to Amazon and its intel on its third-party sellers. But here's my thing. You're a big Allbirds fan, right?
In fact, the ones that have been copied, the same exact model I just bought, I paid whatever. I don't like paying a lot of money for clothes. So I ponied up for the Allbirds, like over $100.
He's wearing them right now.
I just got them. And the exact same model is the one that apparently Amazon has copied.
Okay. So you know what I'm going to suggest, right? You've got to get the clones.
And test them out.
Yes. I think this would be a great GeekWire adventure on your feet.
Wait, so this is an Amazon label sneaker? Amazon itself has made?
Yes.
This is like Amazon
brand. Amazon's Allbirds. except they don't call them Allbirds. They call them Amazon brand 206 Collective Men's Galen Black Wool 10 Medium US. Obviously.
Much catchier.
Yes. 206 Collective.
Dude, I got my new 206 Collectives last week.
206, like the Seattle area code?
Yes, yes. Oh, they do that. That's they think like some of their book publishing imprints. They pick streets, like one's Thomas and Mercer, I think, is the mystery thing. They do Seattle references in some of their specialty brands.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, I'm game to do this. Long ago, I did a Prime wardrobe test where I tested Amazon's clothing rental service, and I did try some of Amazon's own brands as part of that. So this could be the next chapter, and we'll see if they match up to the Allbirds.
So real fast, these shoes look almost exactly the same. The Amazon sole looks a little bit different, but the material is the same. The look is the same. For people who don't know Allbirds, what's the appeal?
So Allbirds have become really popular. It kind of started as a cult thing in the tech industry, and now it's kind of gone everywhere. They're made of this really high-quality wool, super simple shoes, no branding, no logos on it, which people like. And started as a direct-to-consumer online, and now they have physical stores, and they're just really comfortable and really versatile. So they're kind of like the hot shoe right now, and it's interesting that Amazon's basically copying it for half the price.
I want some Allbirds.
Amazon.com.
This is not
206 Collective.
This is not an ad, but I am really into wool.
Well, you'll...
Wait, why are you into wool?
Wool? Because it's amazing.
Did you read the study that said
how much plastic?
There's microplastic in wool. You're going to break my heart.
All right, Taylor.
All right, I'm not going to talk about chicken. I'll spare you this time. But I found an interesting story this week on the Wall Street Journal. After flying, I was doing some traveling in New Orleans and D.C. I'm finally back, but I did a lot of flying, so I found this even more interesting. The showdown at the window seat. There's a new level of tension brewing between passengers who insist on keeping the shades down and those who demand keeping them up to enjoy the view, per the Wall Street Journal. So I think this is interesting because some people, even when you're flying during the day, will keep that window shut. And that kind of pisses me off a little bit. You know, keep the windows up during the day.
But sometimes it's really bright.
I guess so. And I saw a tweet from someone who was on a Delta flight and they said, please keep the shades down so people can sleep. And it was like 1 p.m. in the afternoon. So I don't know. I'm all for keeping the shades up. I'm also for not leaning back in your seat. I don't know where you stand on that.
Oh, you don't lean back? But what if the person in front of you leans back?
I suffer. I'm not gonna cause suffering for the person behind me.
You're trying to be the change.
You're the person who leans back and
because
I can't.
Because the person in front of me leans back.
This is a very good example of where you stand depends on where you sit, because I'm somewhat taller. Taylor, I am right there with you. Do not recline, people. Do not recline. I seriously think I've had surgeries that resulted in part from people pushing their I'm stopping myself from swearing, seats back on my knees. Come on.
All right. While we're on this topic, I have another informal poll.
Okay.
You're traveling with one other person. You're buying seats, and there's three seats available next to each other. There's the window, the middle, and the aisle. Do you get a middle and one of the other ones, or do you get the window and the aisle and then hope that somebody will trade with you?
The former. You got to stay together. Someone just
but
suffer.
But they'll always trade. No one wants a middle seat. It's a little risky, I admit, doing the middle seat open, but the reward could be that no one takes that seat and then you have a whole row. And so it's like high risk, high reward. Mm. And is it really that high risk? The middle will always trade.
I didn't even think about that. That's a great strategy.
Well, I've recently been told it's not cool and I can't do it anymore.
But by someone with whom you clearly disagree.
Yes. with someone that I travel with quite a bit.
With someone to whom you might be married?
It's possible.
All right. Well, anyway, more to the point, I think that the airline should have the ability to upgrade to get the window controls. So no matter where you are sitting in the aisle, if you pay for the window premium, I'm joking.
Wow. That you just want to see chaos on the airplanes. You want to see
people
fight.
They make a lot of money with it. They make a lot of money. I mean, I'm thinking like an airline executive here. Anyway, I agree it's a problem, but I don't think there's a solution.
Windows up, seats forward. That's my mantra.
Sit together.
Sit together.
All right. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm Taylor Soper.
Thanks for listening to GeekWire. Don't forget to subscribe in your favorite podcast app. Check geekwire.com for coverage. And by the way, if you're not subscribed to our daily newsletter, you got to check it out. It comes out at 11 o'clock every morning Pacific time, Monday through Saturday. It's essentially a rundown, a narration of the key news that you need to know. I write it, we write it, as if you were going to be walking down the sidewalk and you just needed to scan and quickly understand what was going on. You can check that out at geekwire.com/newsletters. Thanks, everybody.